Hello, and welcome to the EcoMedics podcast, where we explore how the health of our planet affects the health of the people on it, and how we, as healthcare professionals, have the power to lead the way in curbing the climate crisis and to be pioneers in building sustainable healthcare systems. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Ashling, a junior doctor and member of the EcoMedics team, and we have an incredible lineup of guests who will be joining me on each episode to share their experience and expertise about health and the environment. I'm so honoured to be able to welcome the incredible Nick Watts to this episode of the podcast. Nick is the current Chief Sustainability Officer of the UK's National Health Service and a powerhouse in leading the NHS to deliver its commitment of being a world-class net zero emission health service. With roots in Australia, as you will undoubtedly hear from his accent, Nick is a trained medical doctor, but has been heavily involved in public health strategy around climate change on a global level, serving as director of the Lancet Commission for Health and Climate Change, and founding both the Global and UK Climate and Health Alliance. He's a visionary and extremely dedicated to creating a green NHS through system-level strategies and engaging health professionals within their trusts. Nick, welcome to the EcoMedics podcast.
Thank you for having me. I agree to none of that except that, yes, I am very Australian.
I'm really excited to be able to talk to you today about some of the incredible work that is going on in the NHS. Which is, of course, the workplace for many of our UK-based listeners. You know, we've talked a lot on the podcast about the impact we can have as such a huge organisation in tackling climate change and why there's such an urgent need to do so as health professionals. You know, the systemic change that's needed is huge. And within your role as sustainability officer, these are the kind of changes you're working to implement. So first of all, what is the commitment the NHS has made towards sustainability?
Sure. So let me riff off the first part there before I tell you what the commitment is, because it's important that we understand what we're actually talking about. The NHS is big. 1.4 million healthcare professionals, the fifth largest organization in the entire world, the largest in Europe, 120, 140 billion pounds of expenditure every single year. So we are large, and that's important for a few reasons. It's important because it means that we have a big share of the problem that we're responsible for. It's also important because it means that when we move mountains. So how big? We are 5%, a bit over 5% of UK emissions. What does that mean? That puts you roughly in the same ballpark as a country the size of Denmark, Croatia. It means that if we, the NHS, were a country, we would be the 70th, 60th-ish, quote me on nothing, largest country in the world. If healthcare globally as a country, if we were looking at their emissions, they would be the fifth, sixth, seventh. It's one of those three.
Wow, that's significant.
It's huge, right? And importantly, we have been a part of the economy that has, let's hold our hands up, has been a little bit slow to decarbonize, right? Some parts of the economy, particularly, let's look at transport, let's look at buildings, let's look at the power generation sector, have really run at this. Healthcare, we're just getting up to speed. But so to answer your question, if you take this seriously, if we have a serious responsibility, and I suspect if you're listening to a podcast titled EcoMedics, I don't need to reiterate the reasons why the climate crisis is a health crisis. If you take that seriously and you've read the evidence, then you run at this problem, not at a light jog, not we'll do these three things and then we might take a break. You run at this full speed. And so the NHS, we spent about 9 months, we consulted with thousands of people across the country, patients, staff, climate experts, as well as, you know, engineering tech experts and doctors, nurses, pharmacists. Our targets are designed to be right at the edge of what we think is literally possible. We are not dreaming up impossible targets that we know we will miss. We are dreaming up targets that are right at the edge, 50-50, of what is achievable and yet ambitious. Importantly, is it enough? No, never enough. Never, ever enough, because there's been three decades of the world sitting on its hands in the response to climate change. So the second we gain confidence that we will move those targets forward. But now finally, to answer your question, 2040, for the emissions that the NHS controls directly, a direct carbon footprint, 2045 for our full global scopes 1, 2, and 3, and a couple of things that are out of scope as well, to be honest. 2045 for those emissions. It is, I think I am right in saying, unparalleled in terms of certainly healthcare, and it is up there in terms of the level of commitment and expectation you might see from any organization.
So is that net zero by 2045? That's the goal.
It is.
Net zero emissions.
Do you want to ask me a question about the net?
Sure.
Sorry, I'm being cheeky. I want you to ask me a question about the net, because I get really upset and I get a little bit anxious when we let people, when we let companies, when we let large organizations, countries throw out statements like I will be net zero by, and they don't give you anything behind that. So for us, the questions you must always ask, number one, what is your scope? Then you must ask, and within that scope, are you interested in national emissions or international emissions or regional emissions? And then you must ask, and what proportion are you offsetting? And then you must ask, and what are your interim targets? And what is your annual reduction target? And if they can't tell you all of that off the top of their head, then I think you've got to start.
It's not a serious plan. And that's something that I really gathered, actually, when you talked at our EcoMedics conference. You were so clear about that, about being transparent in our commitment as a health service to what we mean by net zero and how we're going to achieve that and how important that is in actually reaching those goals, rather than just, you know, there's so much greenwashing out there that I think that's a really important point that you pick up on, that it's not just about saying we're going to commit to this. It's about actually having a clear strategy, which it sounds like we do have, which is, you know, really reassuring.
You know, so I've answered some of those questions for us. Scope 1, 2, 3 and some out of scope emissions for 2045. International, of course, because we are responsible citizens of the world. Offsetting no more than 6% for our direct and 8% for our indirect emissions. Yes, interim 80% reduction targets for both of those, and annualized reduction targets.
Can I just ask, what do you mean by offsetting?
Yeah, sure. Really difficult to know if you are the NHS in particular. And so, for us, we won't be touching on offsetting until, to be honest, we get to 2044. And then we really need to think about that actively. So the strategy there is, effectively, you reduce your emissions as far as you can possibly go. And then you go a little further and a little further and you keep pushing. And if there is a little bit left that you can't dream up some magical sort of, you know, technological solution, then you shift that emissions profile into an offset, into the negative emissions component. The kinds of things available to the world in general range from renewable energy generation, but it must be in excess to the grid demand. So it is not enough to simply just produce enough renewable energy to power your hospital. It must be in excess to what the grid is already requiring, and then you must feed it back, and that then counts, that delta counts as an offset. You can talk about AFLU, agriculture, forestry, and other land use sectors, and they have lots of different negative emission sinks in oceans, in soil, in forests. We talk about tree planting as a bit of a, you know, you could talk about CCS, carbon capture and sequestration. I think you might be forgiven to talk if you talked about that in 2030 or 2040 when the technology came along. I think if you're talking about it here as a serious, credible offset in 2022, you're in the wrong decade.
No, because that's the thing, isn't it? I think there's a lot of talk about offsetting at the moment, but actually some of it is just a way for people to feel that they're doing good, but some of those technologies aren't even in place yet. So we're lured into this false sense of security that, you know, we can pay £10 offset a flight, but that's not actually offsetting the emissions. And I just wondered if there is sort of a way to actually do that sustainably.
Yes. Negative emissions are a real thing. Right. So it is true that sustainable restorative agriculture acts as a larger carbon sink, tackles some of the eutrophication processes you might be worried about if you're interested in broader sustainability issues. That is certainly true. So it's not the case that offsetting or negative emissions profiles are scientifically made up. They are real. What is the problem is probably more a political problem than a scientific problem, which is that they are used to look like there is genuine action when in fact there isn't really action going on there. And so the kind of thing you might want to say is, sure, you are allowed to offset, but only in the future and only once you have demonstrated you've reduced your emissions as far as possible.
It's a last ditch attempt just to get that last little bit that you can't quite bring down to zero.
I think so. And to that end, you know, we are pretty proud in the NHS to be able to say that we set that target October 2020. A year later, we hit our annualized reduction target. It was about 1,260 kilotons of carbon. We hit that target. We were damn proud of it. 0% of that was offsets, right? We don't intend to access that sort of reserve until well into the next decade. Mm-hmm. Because what the hell are you doing if all you're doing is offsetting a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's also worth saying we looked at this for the NHS and we said, okay, well, what if you really wanted to rely on offsets? Could you for the NHS? If you were going to take it seriously, what if we used all of our brown estate, all of our car parks, all of the space the NHS owns, tens of thousands of square meters of property across the country? What if you blanketed them in trees? And the answer is you can offset about 0.5 to 0.7% of the NHS's emissions, which is to say it's not a viable option to just offset.
That's really interesting to hear. So what is our strategy?
You said it sounds like we have a clear strategy. Let me be transparent. Our team has a really good sense of what they need to do tomorrow morning. We have a damn impressive sense of what we need to do over the next 3 to 5 years. And once you start to extend beyond those 3 to 5 years, 5 years, I would say, right? Once we start to get to the sort of 2027, 2028, firstly, that is where we have tackled the vast majority of our emissions. So we're talking now about, you know, a remainder of sort of, depending on the scopes, you're talking 20% for our direct profile or sort of 40% for our total profile is remaining. Your visibility over the kind of technologies available to you, your visibility over what precisely you need to do in year 7, 8, 9 of a 40-year journey starts to decrease. And so what we have is a really, really concrete strategy for the first 5 years. We have a series of long-term goals. We have a series of long-term metrics. We have public accountability attached to those. And then we have a process for once every 5 years, aligned with the carbon budget of the United Kingdom. We show up and we go and set the next 5 years of that strategy. So I don't want anyone to think we have a full sense of what 2044 zero carbon healthcare looks like. And I also don't want anyone to be scared that we don't, right? You shouldn't let, you know, journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. You shouldn't let the fact that you can't precisely imagine that endpoint stop you from running at this problem. But to answer your actual question, sorry, our emissions are everywhere. We have emissions, pretty much everything you can imagine. And so we tackle all of them. The way we have set up the program is we have a central team. That team manages out embedded teams across the entire system, net zero estates teams, net zero procurement teams, net zero nursing and medical fellows, medicines, digital innovation, each of the 7 regions of the NHS, right? And what you can see we're doing there is we're trying to say, well, this isn't just the purview of the Chief Sustainability Officer. This is the purview of the Chief Commercial Officer, the Chief Financial Officer, of the Chief Operating Officer, of the Medical Director, of the Chief Nurse. Because if you're going to be successful here, this has to leave the sustainability world.
Everyone needs to be on board. Because that's the thing about the NHS, is it's so vast and there's so many aspects of it that it must take so much collaboration. And that must be a real challenge as being the Chief Sustainability Officer, trying to sort of cater to all of those different areas and take them all into account, let alone how you've managed to estimate the emissions and all that kind of thing. That, yeah, that sounds like a really big job.
Well, yeah, but I'm not alone, thankfully, right? So I chair the National Sustainability Board, and on that sit the directors, sit the people that are in charge of each of the major buckets of carbon. Once a year, they're told what their annualized reduction target is. They set a work plan out to meet that annualized reduction target, and we hold each other to account, and then we publicly report on that. So it's not just me. Mm. You know, if you look at the composition of the board, I'm only, you know, 1/15th of it or something. So in some ways, most of the work is shared out across the NHS.
A document that was released in 2020 called Delivering a Net Zero Health Service Report is quite comprehensive, actually, in touching on some of the areas that the NHS is working on towards becoming green. And some of the key areas to decarbonise are estates and facilities, travel and transport, supply chain, medicines and then research, innovation, and offsetting. So would you be able to just give us sort of a snapshot into some of these areas and the kind of works and what's needed in those areas for us to truly start decarbonizing?
Big question, because you've touched on three or four of the big buckets of carbon. Can I comment on that structure you've just laid out, estates, transport, supply chain? It is one way of cutting up the system, but you're a doctor, I'm a doctor. I suspect a lot of the people listening to the podcast are clinicians. I don't recognize a hospital or a healthcare system in that breakdown, right? Healthcare systems are broken down into community services and primary care services and, you know, acute services and intensive care units and all that sort of stuff. How about I give you, you had five categories there. How about I give you five things that have happened since the publication of that report that I think people should be damn impressed by and excited by and should give them confidence that the NHS is taking this seriously?
Brilliant, yeah.
Number one, estates and facilities. We have invested £577 million into decarbonising the NHS. Just under 100 projects across the country, all sorts of things. They have a field of dreams, they call it, bizarrely, in Hull. It's a solar field powering the hospital. It is new bike sheds. It's new charging infrastructure up and down our ambulance trusts. It is new insulation. It's some of the boring stuff, some LEDs, yeah, but cool LEDs. LEDs that also monitor heat and let us know when we need to be worried about the adaptation side of the crisis as well, and we can start to be concerned about heat monitoring. Travel and transport, electrifying the fleet. We are the second largest fleet in the country, second only to Royal Mail, just ahead of British Telecom. Electrifying that is going to be one hell of a challenge. We think we can do it. We think we can do it damn quickly with respect to our cars, with respect to our vans. We think we can do that by digitizing. We think we can do that by removing unnecessary journeys and being more efficient. We think we can do that with modal shift to electric bikes for some of our community staff, to public transport for staff commuting in. The one thing we've done, and we've done plenty on all of that, the one thing that I think should make everyone excited is when we started and when that report was published, there was no such thing as a zero emission ambulance. Now there are two. One in Birmingham currently carrying patients, fully electric, almost no air pollution other than its non-exhaust emissions. Damn cool, NHS own innovation. Number two, an electric hydrogen hybrid, also made up in the north. That hydrogen range extender lets us serve rural patients as well. So you have those two innovations, you get a third, you get a fourth, you set those guys to compete against each other, you get the nine ambulance trusts of the country to engage with this sort of thing, and then you start purchasing these as business as usual.
That's very exciting.
Supply chain. This is where we talk about our full global footprint. We were very clear in that report, although we were a little ambiguous if you read it carefully. We said within the decade, the NHS will no longer purchase from anyone that does not meet or exceed our commitments on net zero. Someone that reads that should be concerned, because they should say, you haven't given me enough information there for something that is such a bold commitment.
What are those sort of terms, incentives? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How are you doing? How are you going to legally make this happen? What do you mean by within the decade? That's vague, right? So we followed it up a year later. We mean 1 minute past midnight, 1st of April, 2027. How are we going to do that? We're going to add a new qualifying criteria into all contracts that the NHS does. Qualifying criteria, unless you have a carbon reduction plan that is aligned with our own in scope and pace and ambition, and unless it is approved by your board, and unless it's publicly available for everyone to go and take a damn good look at, we aren't interested. It's a new qualifying criteria for the NHS. There's little asterisks. Asterisks are dangerous, but let's be transparent. The asterisk in this instance is for small and medium-sized companies, because we recognize that there's a little bit of an extra burden at calculating some of this. And so all we're really doing there is we're giving just a little bit of extra time, an extra 2 years to get there if you're a small and medium-sized company. The full scope of it, though, that 2027 date, that still captures up to 80% of our full supply chain emissions.
Yeah.
That stuff's interesting. But then you need to also have the interim stuff, because 2027 is ages away. So we've had a 10% weighting into all tenders starting this April. Next April, we have a lower threshold qualifying criteria just for contracts over £5 million a year.
So this is for new contracts that we're okay. Agreeing to. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And so what you can see really what we're doing there is setting a long-term ambition and then slowly walking towards that without suppliers, 80,000 suppliers across the country.
And you say that 27 is far away, but that is also seems like quite a short period for all of those. We obviously work with so many different companies and procurement agencies and all that kind of thing. Is that something that the organizations are responding well to? Is that achievable for them? Are they going to then just sort of drop out, and are we going to be left with nothing? Or is that actually something that they're on board with and wanting to work with?
In response to that challenge, we went and spoke to 15 of our most important suppliers, spanning a whole range of different sectors: med tech, pharmaceuticals, IT, laundry, food catering services. 15 of our most important, largest suppliers. And we said, hey, what do you guys think about this? They responded with, that's going to be tough. But sure, we recognize that the climate crisis is a health crisis. And we recognize that you are the first healthcare system to ask for this, but you will not be the last. We recognize that France and Germany and the United States, and God forbid Australia, is going to start running at this as well. And so to get ahead of this, yes, we're on board. And so we shifted the commitments of those 15 companies, emissions profiles the size of the entire country of Belgium. That's the response. We have a lot of work to do to get everyone to that point. And so that's why we have the team. You know, they've got a couple of years. You're right, 2027 is sort of far enough away that it feels, oh, that's a while away. And then you realize it's 2022, and it's actually halfway through 2022. And you go, oh, okay.
You talked there about the zero emission ambulances, which is really exciting. Are you able to tell us any more about some of the innovation and some of the exciting changes that we're doing?
Sure. So between us, NIHR and the MRC, it's about £25 million of funding going to academics, going to small businesses, and going to clinicians for low carbon healthcare innovations, right? There's a huge amount of money flooding into this space because I think everyone is recognizing that this is the future of healthcare. It is damn exciting. The kinds of stuff you might expect to see, material shifts, right? And material shifts are boring, but they become interesting when we start to talk about shifting the kinds of PPE we're using, right? And starting to shift towards where it's possible, where the technology allows us, where all sorts of things allow us, reusable, recyclable PPE. I saw something really cool down in the Southwest the other month, looking at melting down some of that clinical plastic waste and then reprocessing it, 3D printing it out into, I think in that case, they were looking at trash pickers and then the local primary school was using to clean up the beach. But I think there's a couple other examples up in the Midlands where trusts are doing the same thing, but reusing it for some of their business services. That's a cool innovation. I need to get my head under it to properly figure out what the total carbon, you know, balance is on both sides of the equation. There are some drones. We're pretty excited about these, actually. I think they have their first genuine flight coming up in a week or two down at the Isle of Wight. It's quite hard. If you're the trust down there in the Isle of Wight, it's quite hard to get access to timely medicines, things like cancer, complex cancer medications that, you know, you usually do have to order in. They take a truck or two, they take a boat or two, they take another van or two, and then they eventually show up. And so we have some fully electric drones that we have been investing in, taking their first flight, improving access, good, but also reducing carbon. Manchester has the country's first 19-ton fully electric truck. That's pretty cool, right? It was only 5 seconds ago that we said it wasn't going to be possible to run an electric truck 19 tons on you know, fully battery. So all of that stuff is pretty damn exciting, I think. Is it enough? And you hear me say this again and again, never, because this stuff, you gotta run at it. And we're not just talking, you said something at the start, I think you might have used the word revolutionary or something like that. This isn't just tinkering around the edges and turning the lights on and off a little bit more. This is about reforming, reimagining what medicine looks like, right? And so it means that pretty much everything you're thinking of in your day-to-day life, every drug, every device, every way that we think about how we engage with our patients, we have to start to reimagine from a lower carbon perspective.
And can we talk a bit about food? Because I know that's something that's involved in the targets. And obviously on an individual level, it's arguably one of the most impactful changes people can make to reduce meat, dairy, processed foods, not just for the environment, but also for their own health. And that then scaled up across the whole of the NHS, patients, staff. That can have huge impacts. Yet when we look at the food that's available in canteens or even what we serve to our patients, it's far from healthy sometimes and far from plant-based, which is surely where we need to be heading. So I'm just wondering, is this something that's high up on the agenda? Is it something we are trying to change as a matter of urgency?
So everything is high up on the agenda, right? And that's sort of the great and terrible thing about something as all-encompassing as a net zero target, is you don't get to just say, I'm only going to focus on, you know, one area. Food, let's talk about it. So it is 6%, just under 6% of our emissions. I think it's 5.9% of our emissions or something like that. That's because though the NHS is big, and so that's much smaller than the average across the country. The average for, I want to say food across the country is something like 12%, and the average for AFLU across the world is something like 25%, right? Smaller for the NHS, because when you think about it, we don't serve quite as much food as you might sort of imagine. And when we do, we're usually serving pretty specialized food to patients. It's pretty tightly controlled, pretty carefully controlled, a lot of complex regulations there. Nonetheless, can you get to net zero without tackling it? No, absolutely not. So what are the things available to you? Well, firstly, you can look at food waste, right? And so you can look at digitizing some of the menus, digitizing some of the ordering systems. There's a couple of trusts up the north. I want to say Frimley, but I also don't. They have a cool system where they figure out the food waste on each ward, and then they run little competitions to try to minimize that food waste. The food waste occurs for all sorts of reasons. Patient didn't get the food they wanted, didn't get it on time. Maybe they'd already been discharged by the time, you know, the meal showed up, whatever it is. So they run some really cool competitions there, and they've shown just by monitoring, they can reduce food waste by 20%. And then with the added competition, I think they got like another 10% out of it. It was really cool. So you can do a lot of that. You can be very interested in where your food comes from, and we should be very interested in where our food comes from, right? As a very general rule, if it's seasonal, if it is local, it will be lower carbon. Not always true, and there's nuance there, but you know, it's a general principle we can follow. The kinds of things we've been doing there, maybe I'll talk particularly about the new, that 10% weighting, that carbon weighting there. It also has a locality weighting, more or less. It is interested in investing in local communities, interested in investing in local farmers, in local produce. And that's good, not just for the NHS's footprint, but it's good as well for the concept of the NHS as an anchor institution that invests in, that supports local communities, local patients, all that sort of good stuff. Number three, and you're right, what you eat matters as well. Number three, I think what I would say is we all remember Public Health England. PHE had an Eat Well guideline. It was a really cool sort of guide of the kinds of diets that, you know, would just be healthier, right? I think, I can't remember who did it. Someone at UCL, maybe. Someone went and had a look at the average British diet and the Public Health England Eat Well plate, and they compared the two. And the latter was something like 50% less carbon intensive than the former. In fact, you could get to pretty much the UK's net zero ambitions. The UK's net zero ambitions are a little different to ours, but you could get to the UK's net zero ambitions simply by shifting the British diet to that Eat Well plate. I don't think you got all the way there, but I think you got damn close. So those sorts of things are the kind of thing you would want to see as well. You're exactly right. Less processed meats, less salt, less cholesterol, less sugar.
We'd like to thank Mantara Health for sponsoring this episode. The NHS is the first healthcare system in the world to commit to carbon net zero. However, medicines, which currently account for 25% of the NHS carbon footprint, could be a challenging area to tackle. Mantara Health is pioneering the field of personalised medicine, with their CE-marked pharmacogenomic tests now available to both doctors and patients. Using the latest DNA testing technology, combined with evidence stemming from decades of research into pharmacogenomics, the Mantara PGX test now allows doctors to prescribe medications according to their patients' unique genetics. This can lead to better medication response, fewer adverse drug reactions and side effects, fewer prescriptions, and ultimately, lower medication-related carbon emissions. Head to mantara.co to learn more and use the code ECOMED22 for an exclusive £50 discount off a test for yourself or a family member. Also, something that came up at the conference was, I think a few people actually asked you about cycling.
Yeah.
And because obviously transport, you've talked there about our fleet, and I know that's including sort of, there's a lot of people that travel, there's the ambulances, there's everybody traveling to work. But that traveling to work bit is something that I think obviously puts a bit of onus on the healthcare professionals themselves. Mm-hmm. But the systems in place to do that, I think matter as well. So for example, where I work, it's not really in the best area. And I think that's probably true for a lot of different trusts. But cycling to work is something I would really love to do, but it just doesn't feel safe, especially at the moment. You know, I'm working in A&E, I'm working weird hours, finishing at 1:30 in the morning. There is a bike park where I can put my bike,
sure.
But bikes are constantly being stolen in my hospital, constantly. So there's not really much incentive to do that. And I just wondered if that's something that you're thinking about, because there's obviously a lot of healthcare professionals calling out for that. And what are we thinking in terms of trying to implement that?
Sure. So important for a few reasons. Important for the carbon, right? But also important because all my excitement about the electrification of our fleet and about fuel shift, what we call it, shifting away from fossil fuels to electricity or to hydrogen, gets you a lot of the way there when it comes to climate change. It doesn't get you quite as far as you might want. It gets you, you know, 60% of the way there when it comes to air pollution. We know air pollution kills 36,000, 40,000 people, depending on who you ask, every year in this country. Non-exhaust emissions matter a lot too. And so there you have to turn to modal shift. Modal shift is a boring way of saying public transport, cycle lanes, letting people walk to work. There's a few things you can do there. The difficulty with your question is that it is probably not something that can be done at a national level, because you've just explained inherent in your questions the nuance and the complexity that is specific to the role that you have currently in your hospital, specific to your hospital, specific to whether how rural you are, how urban you are, a whole bunch of other sort of interfaces with different parts of government across DFT, across your local authority, et cetera. And so I think a lot of those decisions probably are best made by the trust at that local level, right? What you don't want is a blanket. Every single hospital in the country must have X, right? What you do want is clinicians rising up, asking, demanding a little more grumpily, that they want, you know, safer places to store their bikes, that they want nicer showers, that they want better access to public transport, that they want a diversity of options for how they travel to and from work, so that when they shift to a different role, when they start to go on a runner late, they have a few options available to them.
And something that you mentioned earlier about how we sort of divide all these different areas within the NHS, and how actually in real life for us as clinicians and people that work in the NHS, it does come down to trust level. And you've mentioned there about a few different trusts that are trying out different innovative techniques. How do you manage to scale things up across the NHS? Because it feels like things are so different no matter what trust you go to. Like some of the trusts are doing incredible things, like Newcastle's doing amazing things when it comes to sustainability. I've heard you talk before about a cycling hub in Manchester that's trying to encourage people to cycle to work. But it seems to depend on what trust you're on. How do we try and get that scaled up? And is that something that's going to take a long time? Is there a strategy that you've got towards that?
The problem you're describing, right, cross-pollination of good ideas at scale to run at a problem, is not unique to climate change. It's something you have in all of medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that happens quite a lot, where you, even when you move departments within the same hospital and things are done differently, and you think either, well, this is a much better way of doing it, or wow, this is crazy that this has happened. And, you know, people even sometimes do quality improvement projects within departments to improve those areas. But then sometimes with how busy things get, that can fall by the wayside. So that's, I suppose we're kind of talking about the same thing here in making these changes sustainable.
We are. I'm just interested in who does it well, right? So a couple of things that come to my mind, GERFT, getting it right first time, do a good job of standardizing sensible decisions for most surgical pathways and moving out to non-surgical. The quality improvements that are world is usually pretty interesting. And some of those networks, what's it called? The Q network that the Health Foundation have, I think, some of that is interesting. NHS Academy does an interesting job of that. My answer to your question, number one, is I'm okay with a bit of diversity, right? So for something as big as decarbonizing the NHS, we kind of need a couple of trusts to run off in that direction, another couple to run off in the other direction. And we need people to try all this out. As long as they are evaluating it, as long as they're communicating that, that's probably quite important, because today, like I've sort of said, I don't have enough information on every aspect of clinical medicine to give you national guidelines for absolutely everything. What I need people to do is have a crack, right? So that first part feels important. Then they obviously need to communicate, evaluate, shout about it, and be excited. And you can do things around that, right? You can create awards ceremonies and all that sort of stuff. That's interesting. And we've done a bit of that. And there are those sorts of things out there. You can fund some of those projects, right? Mm. We have £500,000 regional innovation fund we're close to announcing. If you're a asthma nurse with a cool idea, if you're a clinician in a hospital with a cool idea, we have a small amount of cash for you to take that and spread it out beyond just, the one place you have started to mess around with your idea on. So what I think doesn't work is more punitive, more why is this trust so nonsense? Why is this profession so nonsense? This is not good enough. That will just sort of turn people inwards, right? That will just turn people away. Whereas I think this space, low carbon healthcare, has to be a pretty exciting shared learning space.
Agreed. I know something that is within your targets and something you focus on is making sure that every trust does have a green board and a green representative within their health board.
It is a board member on their trust or integrated care board who is responsible for the net zero targets. Yeah,
and I think that's in what we're talking about. That's probably really important, so that there's a presence there actually at that trust. Otherwise, when it's at a national level, it does just feel a little bit disconnected, I guess. So, in terms of people, if they want to get involved in their trust, green goals and innovation things, how do they do that? Do they reach out to this green board member, or is there a way to do it?
It sounds a little ridiculous, and I think if I look back to myself when I was in an emergency department in Australia and someone said this to me, I would laugh. But it is actually as simple as emailing your chief executive. It is actually as simple as saying, hey, I'm a passionate doctor. I'm a passionate clinician. I care desperately about this. I've just been told that 100% of NHS trusts have a net zero strategy of their own that is localized, personalized to them. And I want to help. How can I help? When the chief executive doesn't respond because they're busy, email them another 17 times and then physically show up at their front door. They're probably somewhere on the third floor, right in the middle of the hospital. they'll direct you to the right person. Right. But what I'm saying is, I think number one, we've got to offer help. So the response should never be, I've read your green plan and it's not good enough. It should be, I've read your green plan and I personally can lift and help and improve on these issues here, right? Number two, the response should not be, and the world is on fire, you haven't reduced your emissions by 1,000,000% today. What the hell, right? So we need to understand and be respectful of the context that, some of these trusts are coming from. The other two things I would say is that there's strength in numbers, right? And so we go out and we ask 1.4 million of us every year, hey, what do you care about? 91% of NHS staff want to see the NHS tackle climate change. They want to see us do more on sustainability. So if you go and look to your left and your right and you go and chat to your mates, you'll probably find that they agree with you, that you'll probably find that they're actually quite interested in taking part in that themselves. And so my sort of answer is, one, find the person in your trust who's responsible for your green plan. Go to them with a couple of friends and go to them with an offer of help of something you can do for them at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. And personalize it, right? The other thing I think I find when we look at like, hey, what's worked really well? And this comes back to your question around shared learning and sort of, you know, thousand John's nose bloom, et cetera. What I think I've seen work incredibly well is when we're a parochial bunch, when tribes of people get together, right? So when the Anicetus as a group get together and they go, I uniquely can act on desflurane in a way that no one else in the entire healthcare system really can. I hold that prescribing pen there. They blew the targets we set for them out of the water. And they came back and said, Nick, you're not being ambitious enough. Let's go. We don't need a 5% target. We need to just abolish this altogether. And the same is true for nurses when you talk about PPE, that fantastic Royal College of Nurses and Great Ormond Street gloves off campaign. And the same is true for asthma nurses and primary care professionals when you talk about inhalers. They prescribe 85% of the inhalers in the system, and they are doing impressive work shifting to lower carbon inhalers. But what was happening there, I think, when you look at it, is groups of people, clusters of people who identified, hey, I uniquely can do this. I control that carbon labor. That seems to be what really shifted mountains damn quickly.
I think you kind of touched upon there when you were saying about healthcare professionals sort of demanding what they feel that they need. When it comes to the role of health professionals in this net zero plan, how much personal responsibility do people have?
What do you mean? 100%. Everyone, every single citizen in this country, every single person in the NHS, every single person in the world is 100% responsible for tackling climate change. I'm being facetious, right? Because there's obviously a lot of discrepancy across the world, depending on your historic emissions, depending on your common but differentiated right to sustainable development. And that is obviously a big area of complex international politics, philosophy, negotiation. But if I can reframe the question, which is, does everyone have a role to play? Yes. Can you get to net zero as the NHS unless every single one of our 1.4 million healthcare professionals do at least one thing at least once a day? No, it's not possible. This is not a challenge that can be managed by a small team somewhere nationally or a small team within the depths of the hospital. It is only a challenge that can be taken on if we're all running at it. The complexity is that everyone's role is different. Everyone has one unique little bucket of carbon that they can control that no one else can. And unless they act on it, no one else is going to be able to act on it.
I obviously agree with you on that point. But I think the reason that I asked that question is obviously you're doing a lot at the sort of higher levels to try and implement these systems to make it easier as well, I think, which is important to make things as convenient as possible when it comes to reducing our emissions, particularly the way the hospitals and GP practices are at the moment are so overstretched that having those in place so that the majority of the time you don't have to think about it and you know that those, you know, we're doing the best that we can within the system already. But one thing I really feel the need to touch upon is that within the NHS there is quite a large sense of burnout, and an element of this is post-pandemic, but in general sometimes the morale can be quite low, the staffing is poor, people are very overstretched, sometimes really exhausted and overwhelmed just within their clinical remit anyway, and I'm just wondering if people have the capacity to, you know, think about these things and be able to take the time when they're already quite exhausted to, you know, say, right, aside from all this work that is already draining everything out of me, I now have to try and think of strategies that I can come to my board with or demand so that we can move forward as a trust.
I'm pausing because I'm wondering if I want to be a little cheeky and ask you whether or not you believe the premise behind your question, because I don't believe the premise behind your question. I think the opposite. I think 91% of NHS healthcare workers want to work for an organization that lives up to their own values. We don't do this for fun. We do this because we believe deeply, primum non nocere, first do no harm, right? We deeply believe there's something deeply unsettling when you see the amount of waste that comes out of an operating theater. You can't quite put your finger on it, but you go, oh, something doesn't feel right there.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, especially during the pandemic, the amount of PPE, you could see the visceral reaction that people were having to throw all that kind of stuff away. But I do think there is a disconnect between wanting to make the change and actually having the capacity and having the energy to feel like you've got the energy to do something like that.
What I think we find is that this motivates, this energizes people, right? So I think we find that actually, and when you go and speak to some of our allied health professional and nursing friends, they say, God, I would love a career that lets me both take on high quality nursing and low carbon healthcare, right? They sort of look at this as an exciting adjunct to the kinds of things that they, you know, want to do anyway. They look at it almost as a bit of a retention strategy for the NHS. Let me talk about that retention strategy, and then I'll talk about, because I agree with you, you can't just sort of nod it away with platitudes. You also have to provide the frameworks and the funding and the support for people to engage with it. So having a conversation with a chief executive somewhere up north, and I'll be vague about the trust, but they were hiring for a new head of anesthetics. And there were two hospitals, Hospital A and Hospital B. Hospital A is bigger, more prestigious, more exciting. Hospital B, pretty damn impressive hospital. Not known for a huge amount, but was one of the first hospitals to completely phase out desflurane. Really takes its sustainability credentials damn seriously. The anaesthetist got offered both jobs. He went for Hospital B, and the chief executive of Hospital A called me up because he was distressed. What the hell? I just lost out on this fantastic candidate. What? And I said, well, why did he do that? He said, that's why I'm calling you. I asked him. I said, the salary was better. The location's better. What are you doing? And he said, the response from the anaesthetist was they want to work for an organization that lives up to their own values. I genuinely believe that this is a bit of a retention strategy for the NHS, because this is something that really, really gets under people's skin. But you're right. You have to provide support and frameworks for people to engage in that. So a few things I've seen that I think are cool. Royal Cornwall, Southwest, has put it into every single job description. That means it flows into all of the annual appraisals. It flows into all of the quality improvement discussions that they have. Every single person working in that trust is responsible for contributing to their own net zero plan, to their own net zero strategy. People then start to get time. They get asked that by their senior consultants. They get asked that by their line managers. What have you done lately to tackle the climate crisis? You got to provide a bit of funding. And so we've done a little bit of that. It's not true. We've done a heap of that. £26 million in investing into primary care and our asthma nurses and our GPs out across the country, shifting from those high carbon, you just don't need them anymore, inhalers to lower carbon. This is effectively giving people the training, yes, but then also buying the time to go and have asthma review conversations with patients. And in those review conversations, as part of a sensible shared decision, talking about the broader implications of some of that. We've started up a new fellowship scheme, because we want to create the space and time for the best clinicians in the country to be able to take a year out, go and learn what it means to decarbonize their own pathways. I spent an hour or two with our fellows just yesterday. It's the best part of my month, best part of my week. We're doubling the size of that fellowship scheme in September, new intake coming in. Those sorts of things matter a great deal. Celebrating, shouting about this is important, giving people sort of encouragement. The £500,000 the Regional Innovation Fund I was talking about, right? That stuff is important because it starts to give people a little bit of bought time. It starts to give them the training they might require. Putting it into those governance processes, the idea that every single trust in the country has a net zero strategy should not be underestimated, right? The importance of that. All of those things, I think, combined with the fact that, hey, this is an infectious, exciting idea, is what gets you there. Do you buy that or not?
I do. Obviously, I'm doing this podcast outside of work because I'm passionate about it. I completely am on board with you. I'm just thinking about some of the people that I have conversations with people about this kind of thing. And that seems to be a lot of the response I'm getting. But I can see what you're saying. For example, at the GP practice that I've worked at, because of this, the funding that's now available to GP practices, if they do start reducing their inhaler emissions, there's an incentive there. And you can see that work, and you can see that really energizing people and people getting together to try and work towards that, because it's something that they need to do within their work. So there's space and there's funding and there's all of these things available. And I agree. I just think there is that element of needing to facilitate that for people, which is important. And I think it's just really positive that there's sort of a board there that is trying to facilitate that, because there, I think there are so many health professionals that want to make a change. As you said, 91%.
One of the things that I think I am guilty of repeatedly, you know, I started, when I first started working on this, I was, you know, working full time as a clinician and sort of volunteering and kind of just doing this because it was fun, right? Mm. I cared deeply about this stuff and I was enjoying it. But I would always be depressed because it never felt enough. It always felt like, well, Nick, but you didn't shut down the 1,200 new coal plants planned for construction in the next 5 years. So you've failed, right? I was sort of putting the burden of the entirety of climate change on the weight of one person's shoulders. And that's something that I think we mess up when it comes to sort of, you know, action on climate change. We forget how much those individual actions matter. In fact, nothing else exists, right? Nothing else other than individual actions really exists. And so when people feel a little bit overwhelmed by the scale of the problem, they go, well, I don't have time to go and mobilize, you know, an entire group of clinicians to engage in this, review the entire net zero strategy, figure out the ways that we can help, and then go and convince my, you know, ward or my department or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think my response is cool, fair enough. But don't start with that. Go and start with the one thing that you can do. Go and start with the one thing that you feel like you personally can do and do that. And then do it again the next day and then do it again the day after that. And then when you're ready, take on the next thing. We don't have to start with the final step in this, you know, 1,000-step journey.
I really appreciate your passion as well behind this, because I do get the impression you're very, you know, you mentioned earlier about going in at this full speed, and that definitely comes across that you're not taking no for an answer. This is something that needs to happen. We all need to get on board with that. And I do find that really energizing. And I think that it's just really, I think it's going to give people a lot of inspiration. That's one of the reasons we're doing this podcast, is to try and show exactly what you've just said, that there are individual actions that can make a huge difference, and everybody has that bucket of carbon, as you mentioned, that they can work on. And then that will then snowball into something else, and that will inspire you, and you'll have discussions with other people and find your tribe, as you said. So I completely agree with you on that. And you're also very, very passionate about the NHS particularly. And obviously here in the UK, as Brits, we do care deeply about our NHS, and it is something that's like a national treasure, in a sense that we all respect our NHS. As an Australian coming in, what makes you think the NHS is so important as a leader in sustainable healthcare? Why are you so passionate about us leading the way in this?
I'm pausing to think about how much of a winding story your listeners care about. I mean, let me truncate it. I've worked in this space for a while now, 15 years or so. I've worked in it as an advocate. I have broken in to UN climate change conferences and, you know, maybe even been taken out forcefully by security, etc. I've stolen polar bear costumes even from Greenpeace so we could stage a protest with and against. It was a little complex, the World Health Organization. I've done the advocacy stuff. I've done the mainstream advocacy stuff with the Royal Medical and Nursing Colleges of this country. I've done the evidence and the science with The Lancet, the medical journal, and with a group called The Lancet Countdown, a collaboration of 30, 40 of the world's best research institutions looking at the links between health and climate change. Advocacy is essential, is critical. Evidence is important, but the world has moved on. And the reason I'm so passionate about the NHS is when I look around, we're not in the world of advocacy and evidence generation anymore. We're in the world of delivery. We're in the world of counting success, not by tweets, but by kilotons of carbon taken out of the atmosphere. The NHS, quite genuinely, and it's Australian saying this, so you can, you know, believe it maybe, is the only healthcare system in the world that is doing that. The only one. And that's where I want to be. I want to be at the place where we are taking this stuff so seriously that we count our progress in terms of what we did yesterday when it comes to kilotons, megatons of carbon.
And I'd like to ask you some quick fire questions, if I may, Nick.
Go for it.
If you could give one key piece of advice to people about sustainable living, what would it be?
I don't want to repeat myself, but I think it might be, it's nuanced, it's complex. Go and do one thing that you will actually do. Don't look for the best thing. Don't look for the hardest thing. Don't look for the highest carbon thing. Do the thing that you will do and you will stick to every single day. we've got a long journey to go on together, and you know, we've got a little bit of time to figure out what that means for us ourselves.
What do you wish you knew sooner?
Lots and lots and lots of things, everything. That action is more fulfilling than complaining.
What will you tell future generations about your role in the climate crisis?
Not just me. Me and my closest friends working on this scattered across the world, we did everything. Ecomedics did everything it could, or we died trying.
Describe to us your vision of a greener world.
I'm not the most creative person in the world, so I don't know if I can have like a short, rapid-fire response to that. I don't know, a slightly brighter shade of green on buildings? I'm being facetious. It's it is something that puts people first. It's something that understands long-term thinking matters, that long-term investment in resilience matters, and that people matter. And at its heart, if you do those two things, I think you end up pretty damn sustainable.
And a pretty big one to you, Nick. Can the health sector become truly sustainable?
Yeah. Yeah. If anyone can do it, if any healthcare system in the entire world can do this, it is the NHS. If people want one thing they should do to contribute to that, you asked me this question before, I gave the wrong answer. They should go to ecomedics.co.uk. I'm sure there's a contact us page there. They should get in touch and say, hey, how can I help?
Thank you so much, Nick. I'm very aware that the health minister will be calling you imminently. So I just wanted to say I'm so invigorated by your passion for the NHS and your dedication to hit some very ambitious but necessary goals, I'd say, to steer us towards a sustainable health system. I just hope you'll keep on not taking no for an answer and make the big changes that are needed. And I'm sure listening to you talk today is really going to inspire a lot of people to do the same. So thank you very much for joining.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for everything you guys are doing. It's kick-ass.
Ecomedics is a non-profit organisation challenging health professionals and the healthcare industry to recognise the urgency of the climate crisis and to implement change to become sustainable. To stay up to date with our projects and events, and for climate news and sustainability tips, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @eco_medics and sign up to our newsletter using the link below or by heading to newsletter.ecomedics.co.uk. Lastly, don't forget to check out our website, www.ecomedics.co.uk, where you can calculate your carbon footprint, carbon offset your unavoidable emissions, access step-by-step sustainability guides, and buy from our non-profit shop with carefully selected sustainable partners. Ecomedics is run by a team of volunteers, and all proceeds go into the running costs of the organisation. If you want to show your support, you can also donate by heading to buymeacoffee.com/ecomedics. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and don't forget to share this episode with friends and family and on social media. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode. Bye for now.